It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret.
Coming up, an open source seed initiative pledge wants to keep seeds genetically diverse and free for everyone. We'll find out how.
But first, our next guest, Thanks Society as We Know It, is on the verge of a major sea change as the collaborative commons of the internet take off. He sees a world where things like information, education, and even energy are shared or freely sourced instead of being bought and sold. The result, he says, will be the twilight of capitalism.
Jeremy Rifkin joins us now. He's a social theorist and the author of many books and advisor to the European Union as well. His new book is called A Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, the Collaborative Commons, and the Eclipse of Capitalism. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be with you.
Can you paint a picture for us? What is the Zero Marginal Cost Society to you? What does it look like?
Well, let me put it in context. What we're just beginning to glimpse is the bare outlines of a new economic system entering onto the world stage. It's called the Collaborative Commons. It's the first new economic paradigm to emerge since the advent of capitalism and socialism in the early 19th century. So it's a remarkable historical event, and it's going to have tremendous impact and implications for every one of us in the years ahead. The triggering agent for this new economic system is something called zero marginal cost. Let me explain. There's a paradox at the heart of the capitalist market that's been responsible for its great success over the last two centuries. That the paradox, ironically, is now leading to its potential long-term demise. And that is, in a capitalist market, sellers are continually probing for new technologies that can increase their productivity, reduce their marginal cost, so that they can put out cheaper goods, win over consumers and market share, and bring back some profit for the investors. Marginal costs are the cost of producing an additional unit of a good or services after your fixed costs are covered. Now, economists have always welcomed the reduction, of course, of marginal costs. It's simply that no one ever expected a technology revolution so dramatic, so it's extreme in its productivity, that it might reduce those marginal costs of producing and distributing goods and services to near zero, making products essentially priceless, nearly free, abundant, and no longer subject to market capitalism as an exchange economy. That's really begun to happen in a very significant way in the last 10 years. If you take a look around, you remember Napster back in 1999? That was the first inkling when millions of young people began to create software to file share music at near zero marginal cost, and they just bypassed the recording industry. Then, you know, because you're in the media business, the zero marginal cost phenomena swept through the newspaper and magazine industry. Millions of consumers became prosumers, and they began to share their own information, knowledge, and news with each other, bypassing the traditional media. And then, of course, book publishing, which I'm involved in, e-books, and especially free e-books, have decimated sales in the book publishing industry. So here are major industries across the information goods sector that have really been crippled, from the recording industry to newspapers, magazines, and book publishing, as basically 40% of the human race is now sharing their own, you know, video, audio, text, entertainment, and news. The real issue here is that economists thought for a long time, well, we got a firewall. Maybe the zero marginal cost is going to affect information goods in virtual space on the internet, but it's not going to pass the firewall into the physical world, the brick and mortar world of energy and manufactured products.
You listed
That's
things
what's
that
now changing.
You listed things that basically run on, well, it's information. Books contain information. Newspapers contain information. Music is a kind of, I don't know, artful information. But what about something that's more utilitarian, like a sprocket?
Well, that's what's beginning to happen. What's emerging now, you've probably been hearing lately about the Internet of Things. What's happening is the communication internet is expanding to an Internet of Things. So communication internet is just now beginning to converge with an emerging, a very nascent energy internet in Europe and a fledgling automated logistics and transport internet to create three internets in one. It's a single operating platform. And sensors are being connected out from these three operating internets to the entire economic value chain. So So we got sensors attached to resource flows and production lines and appliances and warehouses and distribution centers and smart roads. And it's allowing us to see big data continually being monitored, surveilled, and sent back to these three internets. So this allows any prosumer, millions of people already, you know, sharing their own information and stuff, it allows millions of prosumers to begin to go up on this expanded internet using their own mobile devices and own apps and creating their own algorithms or their own analytics so they can increase their productivity, reduce their marginal costs, and produce their own goods and services. And the two areas where this is happening really big, renewable energy in Europe and now 3D printed manufactured products. It's really a game changer in Europe. We've now got millions and millions of people in consumer cooperatives, rural electric consumer cooperatives in Europe, that are producing their own green electricity with solar panels and wind turbines. Now, the price of these harvesting technologies are still a little pricey, but they're going down very quickly because the harvesting technologies are on an exponential curve like computer chips. You know, it used to cost, when I was young, it cost $66 a watt to produce solar electricity in the 1970s. It's now 66 cents, and it's going to go down to nothing. But here's the key thing in Europe we're finding. Even before you pay back the fixed cost for your solar or wind technology, the marginal cost of generating your solar electricity or wind is free because the sun off your roof is free. You just have to capture it. The wind off the side of your building is free, or the geothermal heat underneath the ground is free. You just have to capture it. So we're starting to see in Germany a big shift where 25% of the electricity is now green, and we're heading to 35% by 2020, which is huge. And it's all little players, homeowners, small businesses, that are actually producing this green electricity at near zero marginal cost. And it's actually forced the major global power companies in Germany, like EnBW, E.ON, they've been forced out of the power business, and they're acknowledging they can't compete with millions of small players connecting up to this Internet of Things and producing and sharing their own green electricity. So they're not generating much of it. They're only less than 7% of the new green electricity. They're out of the game.
It's an interesting thing what you're predicting, because our society, at least in America and in Europe too, though I think it's safe to extend to there, it's pretty finely calibrated to the idea of ownership, to the idea of money in exchange for a good or an idea. Could that ever really change in a meaningful way when we have invested stakeholders?
Yeah, it's changing dramatically. I mean, the recording industry tried to stop young people from file sharing, and they went under. And newspapers and magazines tried to thwart news blogs, et cetera, they went under. Encyclopedia Britannica could not compete with Wikipedia at near zero marginal cost. What we're seeing now with 3D printed products is interesting. We've now got several hundred thousand hobbyists and small startup companies that are printing out their own manufactured products at near zero marginal cost. The printers are still, well, they're not that expensive, maybe $1,200. They're using open source free software to print out the product, so they're not paying for that. And then they're even using recycled feedstock, like recycled plastic around that's available, or recycled paper. And they're even using stone and sand and gravel and melting them down for feedstock. And then they're powering their printers, their 3D printers, with their local green electricity from their co-op and the energy internet at near zero marginal cost. Then they're marketing their printed products, manufactured products, on global websites like Etsy, at near zero marginal cost. Then they're transporting their 3D printed products to market in Germany and other places, starting to, with electric vehicles powered by their own green electricity, again, at near zero marginal cost. And they're connecting up to this Internet of Things. So it's only early, but we're seeing a trend line that has potentially catastrophic impacts on a traditional capitalist market. So the real question here that I raise in the book is, if you had an economy where millions and then hundreds of millions of people can produce and share information goods, energy, manufactured products at near zero marginal cost, nearly free, what kind of economic system would you have to create to manage that kind of an economy? And what we find is this collaborative commons is now emerging, and the collaborative commons is really, it's in the social economy.
I got to ask you, though,
the market economy.
Doesn't this create a society where the haves are people who have computers and access to technology, which, as we know, is not by any means the whole world, and the have-nots are people who don't have access to computers and technology, a different kind of class society, a different kind of capitalism in a way?
Not really, because it's the amount of people that have now access to cell phones and the internet is 40% of the human race, and it's going to go up to 80%. It's really moving quickly. There are cell phones all over sub-Saharan Africa, rural India. Everybody has them now. There's 6 billion cell phones alone, and Raspberry computers are now $25, and a lot of the developing world is connecting up into these micro energy grids, and they're producing their own solar and wind technology on site. So what it is doing, this zero marginal cost society and this Internet of Things, is creating a collaborative commons, and it's democratizing the economy. That's why in the developing world, they're all setting up fab labs to create their own 3D printed products instead of relying on big global vertically integrated companies, which they can't afford. They can't afford their products, but they can make their own much cheaper and share it with each other. So if anything, that this Internet of Things that's creating a collaborative commons and a third industrial revolution is a threat to vertically integrated global corporations and a global economy in which much of the value goes to the few at the top and not much to people on the bottom. This reverses that completely.
And we'll dig into that when we come back as we talk to Jeremy Rifkin. He's one of America's most high-profile social theorists and the author of the new book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism. We're talking about his forecast for a global society where information and goods are shared or freely sourced, leading to the eclipse of capitalism.
This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with social theorist Jeremy Rifkin. He's the author of lots of books, and he's an advisor to the EU. His latest book is called The Zero Marginal Cost Society, The Internet of Things, The Collaborative Commons, and The Eclipse of Capitalism.
And we're taking your calls. Do you think today's collaborative commons and sharing things like education, information, and energy will lead to the eclipse of capitalism? Do you want it to? What's your take on net neutrality? You can let us know at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Jeremy, as we were going to the news there, you were talking about the institutions that you thought could be threatened by the world you envision that's run by a collaborative commons style of economy. What do you think people have to lose in a world like that?
Well, we're already seeing a really epic conflict emerge behind the scenes that hasn't bubbled up into the public discourse in any significant way. And it's around the concept of network neutrality, which you mentioned. The whole principle of the Internet was network neutrality. When Berners-Lee set up the World Wide Web, the idea was that anybody with a service provider and a small monthly fee could have access on equal terms to the global World Wide Web. Nobody would be discriminated against. Nobody's information would be put behind the line or in front of the line. Data would not be taken unless you expressly permitted it. And so it was network neutral. As the Internet of Things is coming about, this expansion of the Internet into a communication Internet, energy Internet, and logistics and transport Internet, and now threatens to disrupt the capitalist market by allowing hundreds of millions of people to produce and share their own information goods, their own renewable energy, their own 3D printed products at near zero marginal cost, what we're seeing is a turnaround and a pushback. In January, the U.S. Court of Appeals, our second highest court, by 5-4 decision, you can imagine how the judges voted, the justices, they overrode network neutrality, which is the central protocol of the Federal Communication Commission, and it's forcing the FCC to go back and rethink its mandate. Cable companies, telecom companies, they're now saying, look, you know, we own the pipes. And so we would like to be able to charge different prices and discriminate them on different uses so we can make some money here. And we'd also like to have some control of the information going through this Internet of Things. And it's not just the cable and telecom companies. Now we have some concern with the big social media companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter that have really helped create this social commons. And we all use them. I love Google. You know, Google, I Google every day. They have 6 billion queries a day, but now they're starting to look like a global social utility, a monopoly. Two-thirds of the research engine traffic goes through Google in the U.S. It's 90% of the research traffic in Europe. They have like $50 billion in revenue. Facebook, we got one out of every six people on the planet is on Facebook, and they control two-thirds of the social media market. Twitter, we've got 650 million people there. Amazon, one out of every three searches for a new product starts on Amazon. I use them. But we're all becoming concerned. We love these commercial networks that have created a social commons, but we're worried that they're starting to look like global monopolies, and we're going to have to find a way to get the best of what these new enterprises can provide us, but ensure that we don't end up with the data being used against our express interests for commercial uses, and ensure that we always have network-neutral open access so that we can cluster together, the human race, and begin to use the great power of these networks to actually begin to produce and share our own goods and services at near-zero marginal cost and create a new system in the social commons, which we call the collaborative commons. That's the goal we want to have because that's the most efficient economy. It's also the most sustainable economy because near-zero marginal cost, and I want listeners to hear this, means extreme productivity and extreme sustainability because if you can produce units of a good and service using almost very little energy and materials and resources and information, that's extreme sustainability.
And I want to jump in here and get our callers in on this. We've got a couple of folks waiting to talk to you now. Tom is first in La Crosse. Hi, Tom.
Hi. It sounds like this would be a good way to reduce waste to start with. But my question would be, how would this affect the financial markets? Will the transition be gradual enough or smooth enough not to disrupt the flow of capital to start these endeavors?
Okay, great question. Thanks, Tom.
Two good questions. First of all, it does reduce waste because it's not only information goods that we're sharing on the collaborative commons now and energy and 3D printed products. We're sharing cars. It's called car sharing services. And for every car we share, we're taking 15 cars off the road, privately owned. Young people would rather have access to mobility through car sharing than ownership. That is a huge impact on reducing CO2 emissions. If you're taking one out of every 15, if you're taking 15 cars out of the road for every car shared, we now have young people sharing their homes with Airbnb and couch surfing, and their marginal cost in sharing their home is near zero compared to the big hotel chains. Again, this eliminates a lot of the big hotels and a lot of that CO2 emissions that we see that contributes to climate change. Clothes. We have sites like ThreadUp and FreeCycle where people are redistributing their clothes over and over and over so more people are sharing fewer clothes. That means less clothes are being produced and sold. That means less burden on our global resources and less carbon emissions on climate change. Now, you raised a good issue. How is this going to affect a transition, and will this impact the capitalist market in what place? In the book, in the Zero Marginal Cost Society, I have a section on what we think the tipping point is when we run the numbers. Generally, these global companies that are vertically integrated, their profit margins are very low right now. So if 10% more people in a given sector are buying less from these companies and doing more peer production and producing and selling or recycling their own, just 10% change dramatically affects an already tight profit margin, and it forces a lot of these big vertically integrated companies into shrinking or being eliminated. So in some ways, a lot of them are like dinosaurs. They look invincible. But we now saw an energy in Germany when 10% of the people started producing their own energy, the global power companies, which are huge, started to shake. And at 25%, they literally are no longer the major power generators. It's millions of small people in Germany, pretty much like what happened in the recording industry when millions of young people started sharing music. So it's a pretty powerful, although young and nascent, economic system, this collaborative commons, but it has long legs.
Now, you mentioned some of the obstacles that the collaborative commons has as you see it, including some, as you call them, vertically integrated institutions and possible monopolies like Facebook and Google. So how likely do you think this vision is to actually come to fruition? We've got just about less than a minute left here.
My suspicion is it's going to be a tough road, a lot of challenges with the old power challenging this new economic commons, the collaborative commons, but I think eventually it will win. It's too sweet. And when the technology is available, people will use it. The recording industry was powerful. It tried to stop file sharing of music and the entertainment industry, and they didn't. They went down. They couldn't do it. Newspapers and magazines and book publishing, very powerful industries, they tried to thwart sharing of information goods and blogs and Wikipedia. They couldn't do it. And now we're seeing the same thing in Germany and Denmark with green electricity. When the people know the technology is available, they start to produce and share it. It's just almost impossible to stop it. So I guess I'm guardedly hopeful. I think it's going to be a tough run. But I think by 2050, a majority of the human race will be doing their economic activity on a collaborative commons. The capitalist market will still be here, but in a much more powerful niche role as a partner, but not the dominant economic paradigm.
Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Jeremy Rifkin, a social theorist, the author of the new book, The Zero Marginal Cost Society.
Coming up, we'll hear about a new initiative to keep seed varieties open sourced. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we look at the open source seed initiative that kicked off a rally at a rally on the UW-Madison campus yesterday.
And our resident foodie, Lori Skelton, tells us what to do with that early spring green sorrel that's making its appearance at farmers markets right about now.
But first, a group of scientists, food activists, and students yesterday took a stand against the practice of filing for patents on seeds with the launch of a new open source seed initiative.
This initiative pledges to preserve seed diversity and provide seed that is patent-free to anyone who wants to use it. Erwin Goldman, UW-Madison professor of horticulture, is with us to tell us why it works and why it was important. Erwin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So tell us about the Open Source Seed Initiative. Where did this idea come from?
Well, I think plant breeders have been sort of puzzling for the last several decades about what our future will look like if all of our seeds become somehow legally protected through various forms of patents or licenses. And, you know, while that certainly has its place in the seed industry, if everything became tied up, I think it would be very difficult for plant breeders and some farmers to find freedom to operate.
And yesterday was the kickoff day. Why that day?
Well, yesterday was Via Campesina's International Day of Action on Seeds, particularly focused on seed sovereignty. And that's an international peasant organization that cares a lot about the rights of seeds. And I think as seeds around the world become more and more protected, one of the questions that farmers have is, how will we sustain our food system? And so being able to, say, save and replant one's own seeds, which is a practice that farmers have been doing for thousands of years, or breeding the plants that one would like to breed is something that, you know, is increasingly threatened with these forms of legal protection.
Let's dive into that a little bit more. Why is it under threat right now, do you think? What's happened?
Well, I think you know, to breed a new variety, to develop a new cultivar is very expensive, and it requires a lot of capital investment. So it completely makes sense that companies would want to protect those investments through licenses. And to be completely candid, the university where I work also protects the varieties that I develop through licenses and patents. And I think that is a good way to bring revenues back, in my case, to my own breeding program or to the university. But we sought a way to sort of set aside some genetic resources, some sort of a separate channel or a separate pathway so that we could put some genetic resources out in what we call a protected commons that would remain available for anybody who wanted to use them.
What kind of seeds generally get patented versus the kinds of seeds that you're trying to set aside to make for the common use?
Well, that's an excellent question. Actually, you know, in the beginning years, the big crops, corn, soybean, cotton, and that sort of thing were the type that were being patented. But increasingly, even the minor crops. One of the crops I breed is carrot, and in recent years, a number of companies have filed for patents on a number of carrot varieties. So, if that sort of trend continues with even some of our more minor crops, I guess the question becomes, what will our future look like in terms of our freedom to use seeds? I think because plant breeding depends so much on seed sharing, it depends so much on exchanging genetic material. We call it germplasm. That exchange, I think, if there's an impediment to that exchange, I think it threatens our whole food system.
Are you actually actively distributing these open source seeds, or are you just encouraging people to get a hold of them and use them?
Oh, yeah. Well, we did distribute a couple hundred packets of those seeds yesterday at this rally we held on campus. And we have two seed companies involved in this initiative, Wild Garden Seeds and High Mowing Seeds. And those two companies actually sell some of the varieties that we made available. And so gardeners and farmers can purchase through those seed companies, just as they would purchase regular seeds, they can purchase open source seeds, with the difference being that once they receive those seed packets in the mail, they could then save the seeds, share them with their neighbors, breed with them, do whatever they want, as long as they, too, pledge to not restrict them in any way.
Can you tell us about some of the seeds that you passed out? They have fascinating names. They're kind of fun.
Yes, they do. Well, we have probably the best one is a cress variety called Wrinkled, Crinkled, Crumpled, which I think is pretty well describes that variety. But I released two carrots. One of those carrot varieties is called Sovereign. Of course, this is meant to represent things like seed sovereignty. So the plant breeders, I think, and the farmers who participated in this initiative look to sort of name their varieties after some of the things that they're working on.
Are these heirloom varieties or just special ones that you're putting aside for this project?
Well, I wouldn't call them necessarily heirloom. The breeding that I did happened to come from two open-pollinated populations or two open-pollinated cultivars of carrots. I suppose one could call those heirlooms, and I think some of the other breeders, we did end up releasing 36 varieties of 14 different crops, and so I think some of those 36 varieties do come from heirlooms that have been reselected and rebred by breeders. But some of them represent other genetic materials that would be available from other public gene banks, and they're then bred into a particular type and particular cultivar that's then named and released.
The Open Source Seed Initiative makes a point of crediting the breeders and that, and also part of the pledge to make sure that these seeds are freely available to anyone who wants to use them. As far as that latter goes, how can you make sure that happens? Once these seeds sort of go out into the world, how can you make sure that they keep being available free?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, we're asking people to take the open source pledge. And in fact, we took that all as a group yesterday as part of this this release rally. We recognize that our pledge is likely not legally enforceable, but we're appealing to sort of the moral economy here by asking people to share these seeds in the spirit in which they were given these seeds. And so we hope that that gesture will generate some goodwill among seed sharers and farmers and gardeners, and we hope that they will be able to pass the seeds on in that way.
In terms of sort of the large agribusinesses like Monsanto that say genetically modified seeds and crops are the one way to feed the world, how do you see the Open Source Seed Initiative functioning within in that framework? Do you agree with that?
Well, I do. You know, there's absolutely a place for the kind of high-tech varieties that are being developed by our large agricultural companies. And I would say, from my point of view, the Open Source Seed Initiative is not against that. Rather, it's for something. And what it's for, I think, is, you know, I sort of liken this to a national park. We're taking seeds, we're setting them aside. We all agree as a society that there's value in setting aside these genetic resources so that everybody can use them and so that they cannot get developed or, in this case, tied up. So I guess what we hope for the Open Source Seed Initiative is that it provides a reservoir of these genetic resources in perpetuity for people who would then use them to breed or use them to farm, and in a sense diversifies the seed system.
And in our last 30 seconds here, do you see this sort of these seeds leaving your hands and going forth and, I guess, being fruitful all over the world?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the dream for me, would be that people all over the world take these and develop whatever is adapted to their particular environment, their soil, their climate. And that would make me feel as though the Open Source Seed Initiative had achieved a really important goal, which is that those genetic resources have made their way out into the world and fed people.
Erwin, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on the show.
That was Erwin Goldman, professor of horticulture at the UW-Madison and a member of the Open Source Seed Initiative.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll learn how to take small talk to the next level as a couple of guests help us find things to talk about in any situation.
Right now, it's Food Friday, and we caught up with one of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton, to check in on what's getting her excited about spring, the leafy green known as sorrel. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
It is a pleasure to be back, sort of.
Yeah?
Because this is the first Food Friday where I haven't brought anything in. I'm feeling a little guilty, but it's not my fault.
I can't wait to hear the story here.
Well, what I wanted to talk about today is my absolute favorite thing in spring. It's the first thing up in my garden every year. It's incredibly easy to grow. It's called sorrel. And some people call it a vegetable. Some people call it an herb. It's a leafy green thing that just springs up the instant the snow is gone from the ground. It has this bright, kind of tart flavor. Some people think it's like lemon. Some people say it's got a kind of a sour note that can really add a zing to a lot of different dishes. Now, I got through this winter when the temperature got down to 40 below. I put on my extra layers and I put up with it. I love winter in Wisconsin. I really wasn't that upset. And then when the months went on and we started to have a little bit longer winter, it's like, okay, I can handle this because I know I've got sorrel coming up in the garden.
Oh, it's the thing that you were really looking forward to.
I was waiting for. And then 2 weeks ago, after I knew the sorrel was starting, I went out to pick my first batch. Now, this is how I knew we had a bad winter. Normally, sorrel is something that rabbits don't bother, at least in my garden, probably because it is so tart. This year, the rabbits ate the sorrel. So this is how I knew Wisconsin had a really bad winter. And I was fine with it until the rabbits ate my sorrel.
Oh, I hate rabbits.
Yeah.
Oh, Larry, I'm so sorry.
Well, but the lovely thing is, it is late in April. The farmer's market is starting up this weekend. I'm assuming that even though, yet again this morning, I had sorrel yesterday that was an inch and a half high, and even though this morning the rabbits ate my sorrel.
You moth-eaten rabbit, I'll slice you to ribbons.
I know that there is sorrel out there, and I will put in a plug for next year. If you don't have sorrel in your garden, go to the farmer's market this weekend, find a vendor who has the plants, and put some in, because this is one of the great rewards of having a garden in Wisconsin, is that under most circumstances, you will have something green and bright in your pot or in your soup or in your salad by April. This is a real delight to work with.
Does it grow quickly? Are you hopeful that if you can contain the rabbits,
it does
you
grow,
can get some sorrel
it
still?
It does grow quickly. Okay. And the one thing you do have to remember with sorrel, this is a plant that likes cooler weather. If we have a really hot summer, this bolts very, very quickly, and the leaves go from fun and sour and tangy to bitter tasting. Mm. So this is a plant that does require mostly full sun, although a little shade might keep it going a little bit longer into your growing season. But if we've got a really beastly hot June, forget it. You're not going to see anything decent in your garden until probably September again.
And this is the time of year, too, when we can look forward to things like arugula, watercress. How would you compare that with sorrel? Would you put the three together
Some people do that. When you're cooking with sorrel, one of its drawbacks is it's very, very similar to spinach in how it acts. It wilts very quickly, and so you can cook it in just a little bit of water and then puree it with lots of wonderful things like potato soup or leek soup or throw it in a stir fry. The problem with it is that it cooks down into this very unappealing camo green color. And so I know a lot of people will cook with sorrel and spinach together. Not so much that they dislike the taste, but the spinach will give it that brighter green color. If you can get around the unappetizing color of it, cooked sorrel is such a delight to mix into, as I say, soups. If you are to just start with a little bit of sorrel in with a stir fry. It adds a great extra bite to fresh greens in a sandwich. It's basic. Think about it the way you would arugula or spinach, or and mix it up. Find out what it plays with if you're playing with other greens.
Yeah. Oh, is it easy to come by? Where can I find it if I don't already have it?
If you don't have it, check your farmers markets. Check your friends who forage. There is a version called sheep sorrel that grows wild, and anyone who happens to recognize it probably knows how to use it. So if you don't already have it in your garden, check with friends, and it may be pretty easy to come across it.
I was wondering about that, if it's something that you can just sort of discover. We might have it in our backyard and not even know it.
Sheep sorrel
leaves. If the rabbits don't get to it.
Right. And this year, heaven only knows, sheep sorrel leaves are going to be smaller than cultivated garden sorrel. And it's got just as bright a lemony a flavor, though. And so if you know where it is, it's definitely worth seeking out. If you don't know where it is, find someone who does.
Mm-hmm. This is a strange question I'm going to toss at you, but I know you'll be able to handle that. I know some people use dandelion leaves, too.
Yes.
Would that, and how does that enter the mix?
Well, dandelions are wonderful. As a matter of fact, I made a breakfast the other morning where I sauteed some dandelion greens. And threw in some and threw in some chopped, boiled, leftover potatoes.
I knew I could toss this question to you.
And, you know, just let it talk to itself in the pan for about 5 minutes. Cracked a couple of eggs on top. It was amazing.
Wow.
Little sriracha on top as well. Definitely a great way to wake up. Dandelion greens don't have the tart, the lemony flavor that sorrel does. But if you have a yard that doesn't have pesticides on it, yes, go out and dig up those dandelion greens right now. One, you're getting rid of some weeds if you don't want them on your grass. But again, you can turn around and use those in a very similar way where you might use spinach. I love sauteing dandelion greens. They're great tossed with pasta.
Huh.
And yes, great with eggs. And again, it's a lovely thing to throw in a salad. And of course, the lovely thing to cheat with, wilt it down with a little bit of water or vegetable or chicken stock, throw it in the blender, maybe add a little cream or yogurt. You got a lovely little creamy soup.
Really?
Yes.
I wouldn't have thought of that. And it's, correct me if I'm mistaken, but as the season goes on and dandelion starts to, I guess, wither away for the summer, that gets harder to eat, right?
Again, when your leaves are bigger, have been out for a while, and yes, under Wisconsin summer sun, those leaves can get bitter. It's not going to have quite the same flavor change that sorrel has going from lemony tart to bitter. But I really don't enjoy dandelions much past June. Dandelions, sorrel, all of these greens that say spring to me, I do like them in spring dishes. Besides, by the time we get to June, we've got other things to play with.
That's true. That's true. And it's always something to look forward to. Well, you have a recipe for us to try. What is it this time?
The simplest thing you can do with sorrel is make a puree or a sauce. Take a couple cups of sorrel. Throw it in a pan, again, with just a little bit of water. Wilt it down quickly, and then throw in a couple of tablespoons of butter and wilt it down, let it talk to itself. You can puree it and serve it that way, right on top of other vegetables. It's a great way to wake up the last of your root vegetables if you wanted something green on top of your rutabagas or potatoes. If you want to add a little cream to that sorrel puree, it's marvelous on fish, especially fattier cuts of fish. It's amazing on salmon, on mackerel. I'm told that a lot of people like it with lamb. Again, the way you might do creamed spinach alongside of a lamb. It's not one of my favorites. I really like sorrel best when it's with lighter meats. Fish, definitely with chicken. I probably wouldn't do it with duck, but if anybody has a way to get your fatty duck playing well with the sorrel. I know that sorrel plays really, really well with certain fruits like peaches and strawberries. So if you've got a good duck recipe that incorporates peaches, I could see where sorrel might work.
Interesting. Well, this is all very exciting. And now I'll be on the lookout for sorrel. I hadn't really thought about it much until now.
Again, if you don't have it in your garden, I have to put a plug in for get the plants. It's so easy to grow, and it's so rewarding when it is waiting for you next year.
Well, Lori, thank you so much for shedding light on this interesting ingredient.
My pleasure.
It's always fun.
Oh, I hate rabbits.
That was Lori Skelton, our in-house foodie and a woman of many talents, including being a host at Wisconsin Public Radio.
So Lori seems
she's
bothered
those rabbits.
About those rabbits. I'm a little worried for the rabbits, frankly.
I don't have a yard, so I don't have to worry about this, but I do have a community garden plot. And I think that the reason I haven't had such trouble is because all my neighbors are worried about the rabbits and taking care of it for me. So
taking care of in quotes, whatever
well,
that means.
Whatever's working, I turn a blind eye.